You're listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Materials or items read on Airs LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Hello, I'm Michael Piotrasch. Welcome to another recording of articles from Popular Science Magazine, a presentation of Airs LA. This week's articles include, At 1 Minute, Cow Tipping Isn't Real, and Other Myths About Farm Life. At 8 Minutes and 8 Seconds, AI Makes Pompeii Victims' Final Moments Look Shockingly Real. And finally, at 16 Minutes 50 Seconds, Oldest Traces of Plague Discovered in Prehistoric Teens Buried in Russia. Let's get to it. This first article is from the Environment Agricultural section and is entitled, Cow Tipping Isn't Real, and Other Myths About Farm Life, written by Justin Pott, published June 14, 2026. Straw and hay aren't the same thing. This article begins with a photo, Holstein cows in a pasture. Its caption reads, Good luck pushing over one of these ladies. I grew up on a dairy farm in rural Ontario, a fact that occasionally surprises people I know. I guess I don't come across as a farm kid. These days I live in a city and occasionally hear people confidently talk about the reality of farm life in ways I know are flat out wrong. Here are a few common myths and misconceptions about farms, along with scientific truth. Cow tipping isn't real. There's a belief, mostly among city folk, that country dwellers like to tip over cows for fun, typically while drunk. The myth depends on a couple of things. First, cows sleep standing up, so you can sneak up on them in fields. Second, a person could push over a cow on their own. Some versions of the myth also state that cows, once tipped, can't get back up. This is, to be clear, an urban legend. Even the Wikipedia page for the practice is labeled that way. Jake Swearingen, writing for Modern Farmer, pointed out that there are no videos on YouTube of someone successfully tipping a cow. I checked. There still aren't. But there are some funny fakes. Even so, multiple people have insisted to me that the practice is real. It's not, for two reasons. To start, cows don't sleep standing up. It feels ridiculous to me, a person who grew up on a dairy farm, to cite sources here. I know that they lie down to sleep and get up without any problems. If you need more than that, though, a 2019 paper published on PLOS-1 by researchers at the University of Tennessee shows that cows deprived of the ability to lie down don't get the REM sleep they need. A 2020 paper published in the Journal of Dairy Science concludes that, quote, being able to lie down is a high priority for dairy cows, and animal welfare can be at risk when this behavior is thwarted, unquote. Cows sleep lying down. But let's imagine that cows did sleep standing up, or that you could sneak up on one. This is unlikely. Cows are easily spooked. But let's put that aside. There's still a problem. Physics. Adult Holstein cows, the black and white cows that you see on most dairy farms, weigh around 1,500 pounds. For comparison, a baby grand piano weighs about 500 pounds and typically requires multiple movers to pick up. The Modern Farmer piece I mentioned earlier quotes University of British Columbia professor Margot Lilly, who together with her student Tracy Beckler ran the numbers back in 2005. Tipping over a totally still cow would require around 1,360 newtons of force. The average person can only produce around 660. Let's say you had three people, possibly drunk, who managed to, somehow, sneak up on a cow and exert all their strength in the exact right place. Wouldn't that be enough? Possibly, but that's assuming that the cow doesn't brace itself in response to being pushed. If the cow braces itself, according to Lilly and Beckler, you'd need closer to five or six people. And all of this is assuming that the cow doesn't simply run away or start trampling people, which it will. Put simply, cow tipping, sneaking up on a cow and knocking it over, isn't real. It's a myth. Bulls don't hate the color red. It's possibly more of a TV trope than a myth, but there's an idea in popular culture that bulls hate the color red and will charge anything red that they see. The origin of this one is obvious. Bullfighters often wave red capes in order to attract attention. But there's a problem. Cows can't really see the color red. A 1998 study published in Visual Neuroscience found that cows are dichromatic, meaning they only have two photoreceptors. Most humans, by contrast, are trichromats. The only exception is humans who are colorblind. Maybe you see where I'm going with this. Cows, according to the study, can detect light up to 555 nanometers in wavelength. The color red is between 620 and 750 nanometers. Cows can't see the color red. Given that, why do they run after bullfighters waving a red cape? Because the bullfighters are very good at getting a bull's attention. Any color of cape would work. You have to admit, though, the red ones look pretty good, to us humans at least. Not every bale is hay. You might think hay and straw are two words for the same thing. It sure seems like the people who make movies and TV shows do. An episode of The Office, for example, involved Dwight wanting to become the Hay King. The issue? Every single bit of supposed hay in the scene is actually straw. You might be wondering, what's the difference? I'm glad you asked. Hay is dried grass, clover, alfalfa, or any other thing that livestock, including cows or horses, might like to eat. It's generally green in color. Straw, meanwhile, is the dried stalks left over after harvesting wheat, barley, or other grains. It's inedible, even by livestock, and it's generally yellow in color. It's used as bedding, not food. So, why do TV shows and movies get this wrong so often? There's the obvious. Non-farmers don't interact with either hay or straw on a regular basis and tend to use the words interchangeably. But there are practical reasons, too. Straw bales typically are a lot tidier than hay bales, meaning they look better on camera. They're also a lot less dusty, which makes them easier to work with on a set. But straw and hay are totally different. And now you know. This next article is from the Science Archaeology section and is entitled, AI Makes Pompeii Victims' Final Moments Look Shockingly Real, written by Margarita Bassi, published June 18, 2026. The archaeologists behind the video believe the man covered his head with a bowl to protect himself from volcanic debris. This article begins with a photo. Skeleton in the fetal position on gravel with a mortar near his head. A chalkboard has some information on the side. Its caption reads, "This victim of the 79 CE eruption of Mount Vesuvius was discovered in the Pompeii archaeological area near Naples in southern Italy." A soot-covered man runs down the street of a ruined city, a terrified look on his face as he holds a mortar, the one used with the pestle, over his head. Debris rains down from a dark, smoky sky, and the silhouette of a fire-topped mountain looms in the distance. It's a terrible August day in 79 CE, Pompeii. Today, the remains of the ancient Roman city are arguably the most immersive direct archaeological experience available in the world. Mount Vesuvius's eruption blanketed Pompeii and nearby Herculaneum in ash and pumice, a porous volcanic glass, preserving the infamous tragedy and its victims in astounding detail. Visitors can stroll down the same sidewalks and step over the thresholds of the very shops that stood there almost 2,000 years ago. Now, however, the Archaeological Park of Pompeii, in collaboration with the University of Padua, has taken the idea of reviving ancient history a step further, using artificial intelligence. Following the discovery of two victims just outside the city, the collaboration reconstructed one of the men's last moments in the form of a highly cinematic video. There is a video entitled Pompeii, Parco Archeologico. Death Beyond the Gates. Archaeologists uncovered the remains of two adult men outside of Porta Stabia, one of Pompeii's major gates. While they died at different times, both were making their way toward the coast. The older of the two, who was likely in his 20s or 30s, died as Mount Vesuvius pummeled the area with rock fragments called lapilli. A few hours later, the younger man was likely killed by a highly destructive wave of material, including volcanic gas, ash, and pumice called a pyroclastic flow. Quote, "The Porta Stabia area corresponds to one of the principal exits from the city and was connected to another road that, according to the most recent paleoenvironmental investigations, ran along a coastal lagoon around which there were a series of small ports, landing places, and piers," unquote. Marcello Moghetta, associate professor of Roman art and archaeology at the University of Missouri, who was not involved in the discovery, tells Popular Science. Quote, "It seems logical that the fleeing Pompeians would try to move in this direction and that the victims would thus be found along the route," unquote. Archaeologists found the older man with a ring on his left pinky, 10 bronze coins, a ceramic lamp, and a terracotta mortar, the bowl used with a pestle to mash ingredients. The mortar bears evidence of fracture, and the theory is that the man would have used it to cover his head as he fled from nightmarish destruction. The discovery of both victims is described in a study published in the Archaeological Park's e-journal, but the finding of the man with the mortar represents a particularly moving historical coincidence. Pliny the Younger, a Roman author who witnessed Vesuvius's infamous eruption, wrote that people tried to protect themselves with objects or pillows secured onto their heads with towels. His uncle and adoptive father, Pliny the Elder, died while attempting to rescue people affected by the eruption. Bringing history back to life with AI. The older man with the mortar is the one who features in the historical reconstruction. For better or worse, there's no arguing with the fact that the video is more engaging than simply imagining his desperate escape attempt, especially for people who aren't naturally inclined to be interested in history and archaeology. In fact, the aim of the video, which is described as an experimental prototype, is to make the archaeologist's findings more accessible to non-experts, according to a social media post by the Archaeological Park of Pompeii. Basically, the team used artificial intelligence to process the data they collected from their excavation outside Porta Stabia. They then prompted the AI engine to generate a video based on that data, explains Jacopo Bonetto, a University of Padova archaeologist and co-author of the study who worked on the reconstruction. There is an additional photo. Its caption reads, "The Pompeii archaeological site covers an area of about 163 acres, or the size of 91 football fields." The advantage of the generative technology, he continues, is that it can process the data, generate the video, and incorporate feedback very quickly. As they say, time is money, and simply put, shorter tasks cost less than longer ones. What's more, he points out that compared to computer graphic systems, AI can create significantly higher quality emotional photograph-like and video-like content. Bonetto is quick to admit that there are also downsides associated with the use of AI in archaeology, however. In addition to the environmental toll associated with generative AI, the same speed and ease of use that made it a convenient tool for the team is also available to those who are not scientifically equipped to ground their AI generations in real data and create accurate content. Quote, "The vastness of the archaeological data at Pompeii and beyond is now such that only with the help of artificial intelligence will we be able to adequately protect and showcase it, unquote. Gabriel Zuchtriegel, director general of the archaeological park in Pompeii, said in a social media post, quote, and it is important that we archaeologists do this ourselves, because otherwise others who lack the necessary humanities and scientific grounding would do it in our place, unquote. To use AI or not to use AI? It would seem that the use of AI in archaeology, like in every other discipline, brings both game-changing benefits and worrying risks. The balance must be maintained by humans. For his part, Mogheta seems to approve of the archaeological park's reconstruction. Quote, it represents a responsible use of AI based on an authoritative account of the findings by qualified archaeologists, with the stated aim of capturing the public's imagination and interest through realistic, though not real, animation and conveying the same content addressed scientifically in the study in question and via official channels, unquote, he tells Popular Science. It's worth considering what the victim himself would think of this resurrection. Perhaps he'd be glad that his remains invoke the great Pliny the Younger and appreciate the immortality enabled by this digital rebirth. Or perhaps he'd be horrified by the idea of people getting to witness over and over again what were presumably the worst moments of his life. Regardless, Pompeii stands among the strongest reminders that archaeologists are unearthing the past and its people, each of whom had hopes, dreams, and, particularly evident in this case, fears. This final article is from the Science Archaeology section and is entitled, Oldest Traces of Plague Discovered in Prehistoric Teens Buried in Russia, written by Margarita Bossi, published June 17, 2026. The remains of 42 hunter-gatherers show that the Black Death was already lethal 5,500 years ago. This article begins with a black and white photograph of two skeletons in a grave. Its caption reads, Ust Ida 1, Burial Number 33. This shared grave contained a boy, aged 12 to 15 years old, and a girl, aged 13 to 16 years old, who were found not to be closely related, and plague DNA was obtained from their remains. That they were very close in age but not biologically related and buried in the same grave hints at the relationship they might have had when alive. The word plague typically conjures horrible visions of the bubonic plague that killed over one-third of Europe's population during the 1300s. The bacterium that causes the plague, however, is much older than the medieval era. In fact, the disease has been torturing humans for at least 5,500 years, according to a study published today in the journal Nature. In the paper, researchers detail how they recovered and sequenced ancient DNA from the teeth of 42 prehistoric hunter-gatherers, including several children and teenagers, from four sites near Lake Baikal in Siberia, Russia. The local genetic material included DNA from the individuals themselves and the plague bacterium, Yersinia pestis, which they found in 18 of the hunter-gatherers. Their work represents the oldest detection of plague outbreaks known to researchers, as well as the first unambiguous evidence that early and genetically different Yersinia pestis strains were deadly for humans. Before now, the oldest identified Y. pestis strains were potentially 5,300 years old and may not have caused serious disease. There is an additional photo, an illustration of hunter-gatherers burying and mourning two people. One is covering his mouth and crying. One is wearing a beaver skin on his head, and one is playing a drum. Its caption reads, Artistic reconstruction of Baikal hunter-gatherers from 5,500 years ago burying victims of plague. A tale of two outbreaks. The DNA points to two separate plague outbreaks in the same region of southeast Siberia, one approximately 5,500 years ago and another a few centuries later. At the time of the first plague event, many close relatives at one of the sites, called Ust Ida, died in a short period of time and were laid to rest in shared graves. Quote, the clearest explanation for this mass death is widespread infection with plague, and we find the same strain infecting others at the same time, at another site, 37 kilometers, 23 miles, away, unquote. Rudrick MacLeod, a co-author of the study who researches ancient DNA at the University of Oxford, tells Popular Science, quote, we interpret this as consistent with human-to-human transmission of the disease, unquote. However, the team also found blood relations between victims, associated with both outbreaks, buried in different graves. According to the researchers, this, quote, evidence fits with the same populations over hundreds of years being exposed to new outbreaks of plague coming from the same wild rodent host species of plague, mostly marmots, unquote, MacLeod says. There is a third photo, a black and white photograph of three human skeletons in a grave. Its caption reads, Ust-Ida 1, burial number 44. This shared grave contains three individuals, two of which were identified from ancient DNA as half-sisters with a shared mother, aged 9 to 10 years old and 5 to 6 years old. The third occupant of the shared grave is a boy aged 11 to 12 years old who is not closely related to either of the half-sisters, but was buried at the same time in the same grave as them, and was found to have plague DNA. Even children were at risk. A significant number of children were also killed by the plague at Ust-Ida and another called Bratski Kamen. Child mortality was high at Ust-Ida during the first outbreak and Bratski Kamen during the second outbreak. Broadly, the most serious forms of the disease seem to have impacted children between the ages of 8 and 11. According to the team, the Y. pestis strain responsible for the two outbreaks was previously undiscovered and may have evolved before around 5,700 years ago. What's more, the strain carried a gene that isn't present in other modern or historical Y. pestis strains that potentially increased the strength of the disease, especially for children. The study also challenges some previously held notions about ancient disease occurrence. One is that community-wide outbreaks only took place after humans transitioned from being hunter-gatherers to early farmers. This shift, called the Neolithic transition, allowed for bigger communities and eventually gave rise to the first cities. These new findings demonstrate that the plague was seriously impacting these mobile, small hunter-gatherer groups before the transition, if not others. These findings also push back against the theory that prehistoric plague strains may have been less deadly because they don't have particular genes linked with bubonic plague, the most widespread plague version, and flea transmission. Clearly, this newly discovered strain, which also doesn't have those genes, could be very nasty. In addition to the implications of the team's research, MacLeod was moved by the human stories their work hinted at. Quote, the insight that we get from the way the plague victims were buried is also extraordinary, unquote, he says. Quote, a particularly intriguing example is the case of two teenagers, a boy and a girl, buried together in a shared grave and who therefore seem to have died of plague at the same time, who are not closely related to each other. This might be suggestive of another relationship that they might have had in life, unquote. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's material from Popular Science Magazine. I'm Michael Piotrosz, and I'll be back soon with more interesting articles. Thank you for listening.